Lumen View Technology versus FindTheBest.com. 15-1275. We'll hear from Mr. Wasserbauer.
That is correct, Your Honor. Good morning. Damien Wasserbauer on behalf of Lumen Video Technology, the appellant, please the court. In this case, the district court made a factual finding reserved for the jury, which is the linchpin of the underlying.
Mr. Wasserbauer, at several points in your opening brief, and then again in your reply, you accused the district court of harboring a personal bias, close quote, against your client. Now, that's a very serious allegation. Where does the record contain any evidence supporting your allegation? And if you harbored a legitimate concern about the district court, why didn't you move under 28 U.S.C. 455b1.
I think that if that's the characterization that you or conclusion you come to, I personally
say that again. If it's the conclusion I come to, do you want me to quote the pages where you say this?
No, Your Honor, that's not necessary. In the first pretrial conference, the court certainly, after introducing myself, called me the T word. And then after that, I represented that I'm a licensing.
I don't know what the T word is.
And where in the record is that, please?
Those are that's certainly not in the record, but that's.
Well, my question to you again was where in the record?
The record, Your Honor. I would be hard-pressed to say that I would be more correct to say that this is approaching a bias on the court's stance.
Okay. You also make a direct attack in your reply brief at page 23 against opposing counsel. You say that FTB is making a patently false statement that is unconscionable and unprofessional. Did you file a 60A complaint or a bar complaint or seek sanctions under Rule 11 against opposing counsel if you say they are engaged in unethical conduct?
I have not, Your Honor.
Isn't that your obligation as a member of the bar, if you believe that?
It will be. And, Your Honor, I think that resolution of the factual issues in this case would be supportive of those types of moving motions.
But you've made the accusation now.
Well, I can show in the record that the statements of counsel are patently false and certainly misleading to the court. The buzzwords that they use on, for example, if we enter under Local Rule 6, preliminary infringement contentions, we put the, and by law, make our product and element-by-element analysis available to find the best, so they know what the infringement claims are against them, to continue on for more than a year, to say that our claims are baseless, frivolous, and the court has basically said that by sustaining our picks and saying they're sufficient, that now we have merit to proceed. That's 45 days after initial pretrial conference. That, and they moved certainly with an affidavit from Kevin O'Connor. It says, I contacted the defendant, or the, I made contact with the one of the inventors, but he leaves out all the contact that he did. So on September 9th, Mr. Kevin O'Connor sent a letter to the Catholic Foundation here of schools accusing or coloring a board member, Eileen, and the inventor as a troll and calling her morality into question. That is outside of litigation. That was not included in the conduct of the affidavit. And so they're approaching the court with unclean hands. They knew about that. There was a RICO case where that was discussed. It was brought to the attention of the judge. They knew that certainly various statements that they made about my not providing them information about the pretrial investigation that I performed. For example,
counsel, let me focus on the legal issue here. Is it your view, and why do you state that, that Section 285 does not provide for enhancement of attorney fees?
Oh, that's easy. Section 285 right now, basically, under Octane, will say, look at this case and see if it stands out from one or the other. By the substantive strength of the claim, or was it litigated in an unreasonable manner? All the cases in the district courts that I've pulled since the Octane do not have any of the facts.
But the district judge was pretty firm in her view that it was an unreasonable accusation and your purpose was not to exercise legitimate rights, but almost harassment. And so why shouldn't we accept that?
You should accept that because there's no record of any finding of fact. It's just buzzwords and allegations that were put forth by the client. If she made a preliminary infringement contention, sustain those, then that should support at least going forward on my claims. As far as their claims that it was, or so if you take her opinion at 851, and you go through our motivation was to basically, and as a patent holder, we have the right to vigorously enforce and defend our lawsuit. Our motivation was the license. If you look at our complaint, it's consistent with that. Our complaint puts our claim chart in paragraph 13. It invites a licensing opportunity. We do not move.
Yes, but her problem was that you didn't have any infringement case. And despite being asked by her to articulate your basis for infringement, in particular how the accused devices had a bilateral matchmaking process which required multiple parties to input preference information, she said that it is almost beyond dispute because you put forth nothing to the contrary, that FTBs assist me. This is all about dating websites, I assume.
No, it's actually,
what is it? I don't know.
Your Honor, it's a decision-making website, and it would be allowable under 101 in view of your DER decision even today.
Okay, well, that's not before us. The question before us is whether or not she was correct in not only awarding attorney's fees against you, but doubling them because she believed it was necessary to deter the lawsuits like this one, which she concluded was, quote, frivolous, objectively unreasonable, and that no reasonable litigant could reasonably expect success on the merits. And she repeatedly says that you had multiple opportunities to proffer an infringement theory. There is a claim element present in all the claims, which you never demonstrated was present in the accused device, and which the record seems pretty clear was not present in the accused device. And so, I mean, I'm struggling with why that isn't something I need to affirm.
All right, Your Honor. We did demonstrate it many times. I can count the number of times that I did it before her actually taking the claim in the preliminary infringement contention hearing on the phone. She said, walk me through each and every element and tell me. And we did that. We spent an hour on the phone.
Is there a transcript somewhere?
Well, after that, she sustained our preliminary infringement contention. She was convinced.
No, but
you're
telling me I'm supposed to believe that you proved something from a phone conversation. Is there a transcript of that phone conversation? Did you include it in the appendix? Did you cite it, Your Honor,
and there is no transcript of that conversation.
Okay.
All right. And so
wait a minute. So she says you didn't ever explain how the FTB product had this claim element ever, except on reconsideration motion, which she said was too little, too late. So you're claiming that, oh yes, you did explain it, you did in a phone conversation of which there's no transcript, and I'm just supposed to believe you. This is a fact finding by her, whether or not you ever established this.
Correct, Your Honor. So establishing those things, we established them at many points in the case. Let me ask you this.
No. You don't talk when the judge talks. That's the way it works. Okay. So let me ask you this. when the judge ruled, and you say you knew that, in fact, you had established all those points in the telephone conversation, and you say you had ordered a transcript, where in the record did you say, well, wait a minute, Judge, I'd like you to reconsider in light of this this prior conversation, which you seem to have forgotten?
Your Honor, we actually sent letters to the court. We asked them. We said that there's no record of your finding prior to and after those decisions. When she invited us, we reminded her again that she had not made an infringement finding. She reluctantly said...
I don't think you're answering my question.
Yes, Your Honor. We raised it in letters to the court.
Where in the record is that raised? The judge, you seem to have forgotten our telephone conversation.
It's in the December letter, December 22nd letter to the court.
And where would that be?
I will give you a cite.
Thank you. You might want to save that for your reply time. I'm not going to eat you up here.
Doesn't Octane Fitness say the prongs to be considered in deciding exceptionality include motivation, deterrence, a few other things? This district court judge found that your motivation was to extract a nuisance value settlement from FTB on the theory that FTB would rather pay an unjustified license fee than bear the cost of the threatened expensive litigation. She talks about, she quotes from a variety of your emails and discussions over settlement. She quotes a bunch of them, and I mean, how can I unravel that fact finding in light of all her quotations? The fact finding is that you are looking for a nuisance settlement.
We don't bring nuisance settlement. The way that the complaint is set up, the letter that she's referring to is our initial letter that accompanies the complaint. It's an invitation that's tailored specifically to the particular defendant. All those words are quoted from our standard letter. We craft that letter for a particular. This is not like we sent out thousands of letters, which is the abusive conduct that is complained of in the industry.
How many different lawsuits have you filed on this patent?
I know this answer because I filed three on this case, or on this patent, and in my knowledge, they were all specifically crafted.
It was 21.
There are other cases that are included in Mr. Levin, in their affidavit, but there's no evidence on those being.
And they were all settled. All of them were settled, correct?
I cannot.
And at what stage in the litigation were they all settled?
Those
because in this case, you told him if you settle before you file an answer, then we'll give you $80,000. I don't want to breach confidentiality. Am I coming close to it, or did I just do it?
Under this course,
so you offered
this definition of nuisance.
And then after they did file an answer anyway, you said, okay, one day only, special offer, $55,000.
And you said,
if you don't settle, I'm going to make you retain everything. This is going to be expensive litigation. Make sure everybody in your company knows. This is going to be protracted discovery. There will be full-scale litigation if you don't settle for this amount. And so the district court looked at that pattern of conduct in this case and concluded that, especially since you, at least according to her fact-finding, had never proffered an infringement theory, were simply seeking a nuisance value settlement, and that's why she concluded the case was exceptional and warranted attorney's fees.
The letter that is referenced is our initial letter that gets delivered and served with the complaint. It does have a retention policy asking the person to preserve with discovery. It does have a carrot stick type of, this is a licensing opportunity. The whole opportunity for this person is basically created as a business decision. We do not ask in our prayer for relief for injunctive relief. We put only direct infringement cases. All those cases are direct infringement. We do our pretrial investigation on these cases. We target only the companies that are in need of a license and then meet that criteria. We do over and above what is required, Your Honor.
Mr. Wasserbauer, your time has just about expired, but we'll give you 2 minutes back for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Juarez.
Ms. Juarez, does the record contain anything indicating how the district court selected the particular multiplier as the enhancement?
The district court selected the multiplier. I can't forget that. The district court selected the 2x enhancement of the lodestar amount based on 2 reasons. First, because the lodestar amount was extremely low. The district court had adopted an expedited schedule over Lumen's objections in order to resolve the validity dispute early on in the litigation.
Yeah, but the fact that he moved fast and therefore obviated the need for additional litigation expenses doesn't suddenly create litigation expenses, right? I mean, reasonable attorney's fees are reasonable attorney's fees that it actually cost your client to defend. So
yeah, I actually don't agree with that. I don't think that under 285, reasonable attorney's fees means actual attorney's fees. I don't think there's a requirement in the statute that says reasonable attorney's fees constitute only what is actually expended or less.
No, it's the lodestar calculation, which is the very strong presumptive appropriate calculation. And the lodestar calculation in this case led to, what number was it here, $143,000?
Just under $149,000.
Okay, so $149,000. So the lodestar is the presumptively appropriate measure of reasonable attorney's fees. Would you agree with that statement?
I would agree with that statement, yes.
Okay, and so the Supreme Court in Purdue said that you exceptionally rarely deviate from the lodestar calculation. So why don't you tell me why this is one of those exceptionally rare situations where it was appropriate for the district court to deviate from lodestar and double damages?
I think that the district court not only looked at the low lodestar amount, but also looked at the pattern and practice of Lumen in bringing predatory litigation designed to extort.
Okay. Is that your other reason?
Well, I think the other reason is that under Octane, Section 285, has two purposes. One is to compensate a defendant. The other is to deter frivolous litigation.
Yeah, I asked you how she selected 2 as opposed to 3, 1.5, or anything else. Where does she tell us that?
She, at the end of the decision, she says that she feels that the 2x enhancement would be appropriate. The evidence that we submitted shows that under the AIPLA standard, the cost through discovery would have been about 2 to 3 times.
You didn't go through discovery. None of that happened because she invalidated the patent very quickly and early in the litigation. So why is cost you would have incurred had she not done her job properly a subject for something you should get?
I think that it shows a range. I think it shows a range of what the court considered to be reasonable in this case. Had it been
but it's not reasonable attorney's fees you might have encountered in an alternate universe. It's the reasonable attorney's fees in this case. So why are we looking at portions of the case that you never got to because she ruled in your favor and anticipating what you would have charged your client had those things come to pass? Do you see why I think it's absurd?
Maybe I haven't explained it very well. So I think that the AIPLA standard shows the potential range of actual attorney fees that could have been extended. In this case, the lodestar amount was very low. She looked at the totality of the circumstances. In fact, the reasons that we just heard from Lumen's counsel basically on why this case was exceptional and decided that kind of conduct needed to be deterred.
But where does she tell us 2 is better than 1.5?
She doesn't, Your Honor.
And where is the authority to enhance attorney fees under 285? There certainly is under 284, the damages provision. But isn't unius exclusius ulterius, whatever? If enhancement is in 284 but not in 285, how is enhancement justified under 285?
So 285 provides for reasonable attorney's fees. There is a line of cases, I think, that Judge Moore just referenced, Purdue, where there was not a ban on enhancement of the lodestar amount. There is no per se rule that says the lodestar amount cannot be enhanced when you're determining in the court's inherent authority.
Correct, but that was, this Purdue case is quite specific. Mm-hmm. I'll read it from it. Finally, a fee applicant seeking an enhancement must produce specific evidence that supports the award. An enhancement must be based on evidence that enhancement was necessary to provide fair and reasonable compensation, not deterrence, compensation. This requirement is essential if Lodestar method is to realize one of its chief virtues, providing a calculation that is objective and capable of being reviewed on appeal. The Supreme Court has carved out a very, very narrow universe when you can deviate from Lodestar to come up with a reasonable attorney fee award that is something different from Lodestar. And based on the Purdue case, I don't see how this case falls within that rubric at all, because her virtues were deterrence, and they're noble virtues, and I don't have a problem with it. It's just that the Supreme Court explains why it's so important to have Lodestar, because Lodestar is objective and it is reviewable, and why you can't just make these sort of, you know, shoot from the hip determinations, which is kind of, I think we got a sense from Judge Wallach's questions, you know, we're a little concerned about in this case, that she just felt like double sounded good to her. How do I review that? How can I, under Purdue, decide whether or not that was the right amount?
Well, I think under Octane, the joint purposes of 285 being compensation and deterrence. And then I think also
But all of that in Octane, you'll agree, goes to whether or not a case is deemed exceptional. I don't see anything in Octane that suggests that those are, in fact, the factors to then assess when determining the amount of reasonable attorney's fees. Do you? I mean, do you think in Octane I should interpret the Supreme Court's determination of an amount of reasonable attorney's fees as to basically overrule Purdue and adopt a much broader theoretical, you know, let me consider all these mushy factors to come up with an amount? You think they were saying Lodestar is no longer the way to go?
No, I don't think that's what they're saying. And I don't think that I'm asking you to overrule Purdue by affirming the lower court's decision. I think that the district court has the inherent authority to assess the amount of reasonable fees that it thinks is appropriate.
They have the inherent authority under 1927, right, mm-hmm. to do more, to do something different than what they did here. And maybe that's what you'll ask her to do if we don't find in your favor, is maybe go Rule 11, go 1927. If we don't agree with you that the statute allows for enhancement, don't you have other avenues where you can attempt to seek the same? And given the way she wrote the opinion, it seems she felt pretty strongly that this was a baseless litigation.
I think that we could seek the relief under other avenues, but I also think that this court's existing jurisprudence supports an enhancement. I think that even under electromechanical, which is one of your opinions, you left room and contemplated that perhaps 285 would allow for enhancement. I believe that it could be part of a reasonable fee award, but just in that case, there was no evidence presented to justify an award in excess of actual fees. But this court has contemplated in the past. In Mathis, the court contemplated that 285 is not limited to reimbursement of amounts paid only for legal fees. In Junker, the court said that actual fees are not a ceiling under 285.
Ms. Morris, I want to give you a chance to discuss your supposed fraud. I have to tell you, if I was you, I would have gone to the bar and said, I have this accusation against me. I want it resolved. And if you resolve it in my favor, then here's my complaint against opposing counsel. I always took that kind of language extremely seriously. Tell me about it.
Would you like to hear about why the representations were that counsel made were false? Would you like to hear what I plan to do about it?
No, you tell me why they were false.
Okay. So there were a number of statements that counsel made with respect to the arguments that we pointed out were raised newly on appeal. The counsel pointed to preliminary infringement contention, to a phone conversation with the court, and to a letter that was submitted to the court. So throughout the case, in the infringement contentions, in plaintiff's claims construction briefing, in the interrogatory responses, in the briefing on the motion for exceptional case, the same position was held with respect to infringement, which is that the first preference data was submitted by a user of the website. So a user would go to the website and say, for instance, that they wanted to find out information on what dog breed best suited them. So they would put in information about the size of dog they wanted.
So definitely not a dating website.
Although, if you think first preference and a second preference, you think is matchmaking. Definitely. No, so Find the Best website is essentially, it compiles information and it allows users to go in and query. For instance, if you're torn between an Apple and Samsung phone, you can go and put in your screen size, battery life requirements, and it will return something that's recommended for you. So throughout the litigation, Lumen said that constituted entry of first preference data. The second preference data, Lumen contended, was entered by companies who wanted to edit their listings or input new listings. Then, in the motion for reconsideration, Lumen suddenly decided that there's another set of preference data that arose from Find the Best going out and gathering information, perhaps filling in gaps where it didn't have information for instance, for screen size or something like that. The courts decided that those arguments were untimely and that they were new arguments that were not considered through the course of the exceptional case briefing and had not been raised before. And then Lumen repeated those arguments to this court. So those were new. That's what we said. We said they were newly raised in the motion for reconsideration and raised again on appeal. Not that there was a misrepresentation that they were new. With respect to the telephone conversation that opposing counsel refers to, that was actually a conference with the court on the sufficiency of its infringement contentions. There's a local rule in the Southern District of New York regarding the substance of infringement contentions. We believed that the infringement contentions that were submitted did not meet the procedural requirements. We talked to the court. The court said these actually do meet the procedural requirements, but did not rule on the sufficiency or the substance of the infringement arguments in those contentions.
Was there a transcript made of that thing?
You know, I don't know. I assume there was, and counsel said that he ordered it, but I have not seen it.
Okay.
No. And then thirdly, counsel pointed to a letter that was included, or that was sent to the court. I believe he said, I can't remember actually what he said the letter was for, but it's A694, and it was basically just to add some information about the PIC dispute, the infringement contention dispute, on the record. It was not a letter in which the infringement contentions or infringement theories were explained to the court.
So you found his site for him.
Well, I presume this is the letter that he was referring to.
Okay.
Was the letter that was sent to the court, and it was merely procedurally to correct and make sure there were some overlapping cases, and some documents had been entered in one case but not the other. So I just want to return to the court's underlying basis for the 285 decision, that it was a prototypical exceptional case. I think this court summed up very well the court's reasons for determining that this was an exceptional case, and I do not believe it's an abuse of discretion. When it comes to the enhancement of the lodestar factor, all aspects of the court's 285 decision are reviewed for abuse of discretion. And I do believe that in the court's inherent authority...
How do we review it if she doesn't tell us?
Doesn't tell you what?
How she did it.
So this goes back to the one and a half times.
Yes, it does, indeed.
I think that justification, looking at the dollar amount of the lodestar amount, which was under $150,000, and knowing that the court did, that there were 20 other litigations that were settled, presumably for a similar amount that was demanded from Find the Best, justifies.
She tell us that? Amount. Did she tell us that somewhere in the record?
No, Your Honor.
There you go.
Is there any case you can point me to where an enhancement to attorney's fees was based on deterrence principles?
I am not aware of one. I don't believe that the court was aware of anything under 285.
Are you? I'm not saying under 285. I mean at all. I mean, Purdue has nothing to do with 285, right? And Purdue is the leading case in your favor on the notion that reasonable attorney's fees can include an enhanced amount in certain limited circumstances, can go beyond Lodestar.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any other case following Purdue that you're aware of from the regional circuit that you think would be helpful to you? Because I think that Purdue lays out a very narrow set of circumstances in which enhancement can occur, and this case doesn't fall within those circumstances.
Well, I would argue that there are cases that allow for awards other than attorney's fees, for instance, expert fees. And I believe that that would be considered a deterrent. So if you have, you see somebody go up, they go on into litigation, and then they lose, and their award, the other side is awarded not only its attorney's fees, but hundreds of thousands of dollars in expert fees, for instance. That could be considered a deterrent award. And the court has said that in certain cases, in rare cases, awards of expert fees are also justified under 285.
But this isn't an award of expert fees either, is it?
No, but it's an award of a multiplier to deter future cases.
Well, the court also has powers, inherent powers to, for instance, issue an order to show cause. And if it finds cause, it can fine a party or counsel, and that's a deterrent, and that's directly a deterrent.
Correct. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Ms. Juarez. Mr. Wasserbauer has 2 minutes for rebuttal if he needs it.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. Your site is actually two letters. One is 1363-64 and 1390-91. The court did not, I'm thinking about this, the court really didn't give us a chance to bring and set forth the what she would say, to prove our case on an infringement side. There was no hearing, and we weren't given that opportunity. There's no finding. She could have had a hearing if she wanted to, but we didn't. We went through the discovery schedule, we put forth our claim constructions, and we matched up line by line, told them about Hartman, told them about what she should be doing, how this claim matches up. In discovery, we basically showed that Kevin O'Connor, in a Wall Street Journal article, told us that he is doing the counterparty, which is the what all along the judge is saying, there's no counterparty, there's no third-party counterparty. That's Kevin O'Connor saying in a Wall Street Journal, it's a mission of a party opponent. That's what I reviewed pre-investigation, saying we do bilateral matching, we do it, and we do it in this way. We also found, and they submitted in their brief at 1351 to 58, actual questionnaires that the experts fill out.
Is that newspaper reference admissible in the record? Where is it in the record, and how was it made admissible?
Okay, I did that pre-filing investigation when they asked me in Interrogatory 15 what I did. I said I did all these things normal patent attorney would do, and then some. Plus, here is an additional piece of evidence that I reviewed. And I gave that to them. We transcribed, that's been there since October 3rd, before any of the rulings of this court. And they have ignored it. The court has ignored it. I bring it up, I've done my best. As far as the Lodestar, this case has defined a nuisance value as 10%. SPK case, recent case, at 10% of the presumed what you could get damages. The awarded damages minus 85, Your Honor, would amount to about 50%. So if this is not 10%, it can't be nuisance.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserbauer. As you see, your time is up. We will take the case under advisement.